Hello and big welcome to the premiere episode of my new podcast, Sports Life Balance. I'm two-time U.S. Olympian and three-time Emmy-winning producer, John Moffat. And it probably won't surprise you to learn that I love athletes and also trying to figure out really what makes them tick. But it's not just points on the board or who won what or training tips that interest me. On this podcast, we're going to explore why sports are such a big part of being human. And let me tell you, it's not just superstar athletes on this show. And in season one, I think you're in for a treat. I'll interview coaches, educators, best-selling authors, even Hollywood icons, anyone whose life has been transformed and enriched by athletics. So let's dive in. You might know today's guest as Seth Bullock in Deadwood or Raylan Givens on Justified, or maybe from a multitude of his roles in television and film. Timothy Oliphant's incredible acting career has spanned four decades, and as you will find out, to this day he's still realizing his childhood dreams. So you might be wondering, why is he a guest on Sports Life Balance? That's because long before Timothy Oliphant was a bona fide Hollywood star, he was a Division I athlete at USC. Timothy Oliphant, it is so great to have you here.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
I am super excited to kind of like understand some of the things that might make you tick behind the scenes. And I know you're a sports fan, but everyone, of course, knows you as the actor.
Yeah.
We go way back.
Way back.
Yeah.
And now we're neighbors.
And we have been neighbors for a long time but haven't realized it.
Yeah.
You know, we're both LA guys. We have been in LA for a long time.
Yeah.
Okay. So we kind of have to start with our hometown teams. I mean, since we're going to be talking about sports.
Okay. Let's go.
What about the Lakers? I mean, come on. They did bring it home.
You know, they did. And I was very happy for that. I found myself rooting for them. I have to say, when I came to LA, being a NorCal guy who rooted against the Lakers my whole life, I never really got behind the... I refused to become a Laker fan when I came here back in... I guess 1990 or something like, well, anyway. So I adopted the Clippers because none of my hometown buddies and friends and brothers would fault me for that because they suck so bad. They were like, that's fine, root for them. So I had a tough postseason with the Clippers. That was a tough, very tough season. We thought we were going to get a Laker-Clippers division playoff, but they kind of fell apart.
I mean, you got to hand it to LeBron coming to town.
You know what? I love that guy. I've really just I like everything he does. I like the show on the HBO. I always just love the NBA. I just really was very moved. It was such a curious thing in this very polarizing time during the civil unrest. Mm-hmm. But I just I'm all for everything they did. I love the way they did it. I loved. I don't know. I like that league. It was pretty cool. And then Dodgers came after that.
Well,
and oddly enough, I have no problem rooting for the Dodgers. I don't know why.
Well, it's certainly an easy team to root for, especially the way they played this season.
Right.
And the past few seasons,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't know why. I guess I was more of a basketball fan growing up, so I really, really rooted for the Sacramento Kings back in those 90s or when they were up against the Lakers. And I loved Golden State growing up. Still love Golden State. So I just was like, where are we on the language on this show? I was like, fuck the Lakers. Fucking hate the Lakers. You'll appreciate it. This is the epitome of everybody in show business. And maybe this is true of life, but this sums up exactly this who I really am. For my whole life, I'm just like, fuck the Lakers and Shaquille O'Neal and God rest his soul, Kobe Bryant. You know, I just trashed them. I was like, those guys don't know how good they got it. They're a bunch of babies and da-da-da and Shaquille O'Neal and trash, trash, trash. And one day I'm doing a talk show and I'm back there in the green room and they say, yeah, the other guest is Shaquille O'Neal. And I'm like, you know, Shaquille O'Neal. And I walk out in the hallway and there's Shaquille O'Neal. Yeah,
big,
huge, huge guy. He looks at me and goes, hey, man, I'm a big fan. And I look at him and I say, I'm a big fan of yours. and I was like, now from that day on, anytime anyone says anything bad about Shaquille, I'm like, hey, hold up a second. He's a pretty good guy. All he had to say was he was a fan. And Now I'm a big Shaquille. I like that guy.
Yeah, indeed. And back to the Dodgers. I am traditionally not a stick and ball fan. I just haven't followed those types of sports as much. And over the past few years, my fan experience with the Dodgers has been fantastic. And of course, them coming back and you know, the shortened season and missing sports and all that stuff.
It's the best.
I mean, they're such a solid team. You could see when they're up, they're down, they cover each other's mistakes.
Yeah.
I mean,
Clayton, God love him. I so was just like, please just let him win.
I'm so with you and for all the guys. And look, we've talked about the pandemic a little bit and 2020, come on. And it just wouldn't be 2020 if we didn't have the whole Justin Turner.
I know that was crazy. Oh my God. That was just such a bizarre little sort of right at the end. Like, why? Just the hits keep coming,
right? I mean, and you know, I always look at things because as we're both athletes, I can always relate to those celebrations.
Yeah,
because those celebrations are what you dream of as a kid.
Yeah,
like I guarantee you, every single kid that's ever played baseball dreams of celebrating with his fan with his fans, with his teammates on the field after they won the World Series.
Yeah.
And there was people telling him he can't do it.
I know.
I guarantee.
I know.
I mean, heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking. But he did go out and do it. And then there are people telling him why he should have never done that.
It's a no-win.
It's a no-win situation.
Even though they won.
You know, they're all a bunch of... that just sums up the year and how everyone... to me, that moment of him being out on the field, the photograph of him being out there, knowing he's tested positive, taking a photograph with that team, I mean, that is, in a nutshell, what we're all dealing with. How do you handle it? What do you do? When do you draw the line? The crowd mentality of once you get with a group, you let your guard down. You know that all those guys... by and large, are going to be fine.
Yeah.
Even if they did get it, they're outdoors.
Right.
It's one of those things where, as much as he was taking, I saw a lot of articles saying he should have never been out there. That was totally irresponsible. The message. But on the other hand, everything I've read about this virus says that in a situation that he's in right there, outdoors for a very limited amount of time, the chances of that being a problem is a very slim, right? Isn't that what it's all about? It's all about long periods of time indoors at extended period of time for that's the most dangerous, right? It's so complicated.
It's so complicated.
And everyone's, there's so much confusion out there. I don't know. It's just a year.
Jeez. I know. It's just crazy.
Hits just keep on coming.
Well, it's been 32 years since the Dodgers won last. And if I do my math correctly, you were at USC, weren't you? A student SC last time they won.
That's right. God, I don't remember that at all. I don't tie that memory of them winning the World Series and to that. I don't connect it.
In college, you're a little busy. You don't necessarily,
Yeah. Yeah, I don't connect it at all. Isn't that funny? I mean, memory's a very tricky thing, and you tend to compartmentalize and blend and stuff. But
no, I mean, that's
you.
That's
Do you remember being in college and watching?
I was,
or just out.
I don't remember watching, but I do remember I was visiting my now wife, but she was my girlfriend, and she was still up at Stanford. And
so you and your wife met in college?
Yeah, she was a swimmer.
So did
at
my wife
as well.
So did my wife.
There
and
we
I,
go.
We met in college. How about that?
I know. It's crazy. Been together for a long time. So
yeah, we're coming up on 30 years.
Well, yeah, we're 28, so almost. It's.
Wow.
I feel so fortunate that I have been able to find my soulmate, somebody that I like to see at the end of the day.
Yeah. And we can't stand each other, but we just but we're in it. We're in it to win it. So we're just going to stick it out. I feel like we're going to come around soon. I feel like. I don't know. I just feel like it's got potential. I'm sticking with it.
You're developing. You're developing. So let's talk about college a little bit. Your time at SC.
Let's hear it.
You were a swimmer.
I was.
I know that because we swam together for
a
brief time.
We swam together.
We'll go back to that in a minute. But tell me a bit about SC and the legendary program that is SC and entering that and becoming part of it.
It was, it's funny. The first word I was about to say is it was overwhelming for me. It was remarkable. It was so exciting. I grew up in Modesto, California, where, you know, I was a big fish in a small pond. it sounds so foolish. Sounds like I'm, but I was like, you know, San Joaquin section record holder coming out of, you know, but it's still a pretty small pond, San Joaquin section. So I was a solid swimmer coming out, but I was on that bubble of being an elite mid-sized Division I swimmer or go to a program like a USC and be one of, be sort of not the, you know, I was not an, like, you know, American record holders, Olympians. Right. There was, we had a stacked team of crazy talent. So for me to choose to go to USC as opposed to UC Santa Barbara and be, I was so excited to see what I could do in a program where, you know, I wasn't the top guy.
Right.
And it was intense. Those guys were, I say those guys were my teammates, my friends now, but I remember that first year going, holy shit, I didn't know this. I didn't know this was possible.
Right.
See.
But it's like that on all levels. I mean, I had already made an Olympic team when I entered college, so I was...
It's not about you, John.
No, but but I can relate because my college experience, swimming, Division I level for 4 years, was the hardest thing I've ever done.
Really?
Absolutely.
Wait, I want to hear more about this.
Brutal. You, well, it's not about me.
But yeah, you, that's true, by the way. Let's keep that in mind. Come on. Didn't I? Did you not hear my Shaquille O'Neal story? Did you not know how this works? You're supposed to just kiss my ass, and that's what makes us friends.
Okay, I'll get back.
I'm in show business. Listen to me. All right, look it. Wait, you had already made Olympic team in high school?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
My God. So see, you showed up, and you were like, you were that guy. I was the other guy.
But it's still, I mean, there was, it was coming at me from all angles. I mean, to think that somebody at that level, and you swam with a lot of people at that level, to not think that they're getting their butts kicked too.
Yeah.
Look, swimming is hard. We've established that. And it makes us tough, right? We're tough.
We'd like to think so.
Now we're tough. Yeah, right.
No one was trying to hit us, but yeah, it was, we were tired at the very least.
We were tired. Exactly.
I ate a lot. I just remember breakfasts. That's the other thing is I remember going to breakfast in the dorms with the team. And a lot of times we'd buy the upperclassmen breakfast. And I remember those I still think back, like a tray of food with three plates, a plate of pancakes, a plate of eggs, and then a plate like of cereal.
Yep.
And just sitting down and just like grazing. Wolfing. Yeah.
We would have dozen egg omelets.
Yeah.
it's so absurd, but we were like, hey, I need a dozen egg omelets.
You know, on Sundays, I remember my sophomore year, I remember going down and getting a dozen donuts and splitting it with my buddy. I can't imagine. It's hard to get a half a donut down right now.
Oh, and I'm in a funk after one donut.
I'm like, what the hell? There's so much sugar in here. We just split a dozen. I remember buying a pint of ice cream with Chris, all those guys. We'd all go to Baskin Robbins and we'd all buy pints. Wasn't a cone. We'd all get our individual pints.
I know the absurdity. It's a long time ago, but there's another element to college, right? We had to go to school.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about your academic pursuits and how you started to develop your interests and how they ultimately led you to what you're doing right now.
So I was a fine art major at USC. I was in the art department, which, again, growing up Modesto, show business was a, you know, that was just a little kernel of an idea that I was suppressing in the back of my head. So, but I drew a lot growing up. And something I was good at, you know, one of those things you draw for people and make flyers for keg parties. And on my recruit trip to USC, I actually was going into the architecture school, having no, really, when you think about it, as a senior, now having my own kids, I was so, I mean, so behind the curve. My kids were way ahead of the curve. Like when I look back, my kids, like they know what they want to do. Art, music, things like that, that they're interested in. There's not a, they don't blink an eye about, oh, can you could make, I remember thinking, wait, this is, I didn't even know you could major in art. I don't, right. My memory is, I didn't even know that was something you could get a degree in. I stumbled on it when I walked and I came out to USC on my recruit trip. I went over to the architecture program, which is upstairs, above the fine art building. Yeah. It's in the same part of the campus. And the guy just immediately told me, it was nice to meet you, but if you're here for swimming, you can't be an architecture student. It's impossible, right, to, those classes are long, long, long hours. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason there's a architecture fraternity. It's just, there's no room in that program for you to also be a Division I athlete. And I was like, what was that downstairs?
Yeah, you know? Right.
He said, that's the art department. And I said, can I talk to them? And he said, sure. So he walked me down and introduced me to the head of the art department. And I said, I'm here and swimming. And they said, yeah, we can work around that. And I went home and I couldn't believe it. I told my parents, I was like, you know, they got an art program there. And they're like, yeah. And I was like, so I could do that? And they're like, go for it. So
that's cool.
That was, I dropped out of math in, that day. I went to, I realized if, as an art major, I was already ahead of the game. I didn't need a foreign language. I'd already done my requirements. And so I dropped like two classes in high school, my senior year, because I was like, I'm an art major. Anyway. Well, so I studied art and then, you know, long story short, I was trying to avoid a midlife crisis. I was like, well, let's
just, at 22 years old.
I think at the time, my parents who had divorced and, I think I saw with my dad a little bit, like he was going through that. And I just thought, wow, these are all things you realize he's just things he probably should have pursued years ago, as opposed to, you know,
right,
that are kind of catching up to him. And so I was like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to wake up, you know, in my 40s and say, oh my God, what am I doing this for? This, and I never wanted to do it. Not that art was that, but I was, I starting to entertain an idea of, this is what happened. I was starting to entertain the idea of being going into advertising. Oh, I can use my art major for this practical, here's a practical application for my talents. And I thought, what am I doing? You know, I never want to do that. I don't want to do that. I'm just like, you know, if you're going to, I really wanted to be an artist.
Yeah.
And then there was other things like acting that I always had thought about. Right. And so anyway, I took a class. I needed a class. I took an acting class. I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife, I was like, you know, there's something I'm thinking about. And she's like, just do something.
That's so cool. You had the support.
Yeah. So we moved to New York and there we go, into acting. At the time, I remember thinking, I go for this acting thing. And I think it's going to be a ton of fun. I can always still do my, stay involved in the arts and make it a part of my life. And I had in the back of my mind, somewhere along the line, I kept thinking when I get older, I could really kind of dive back into it if I keep it alive, you know, once this thing kind of starts to take care of itself.
Did you experience any of that? We talked a little bit about it earlier today, but that just horrible void that when you retire from your sport and kind of like that aimless feeling, like I didn't retire. I kind of had to reinvent myself. Did you feel like compelled to just kind of turn your back on all that? Or did you embrace that and move forward?
My swimming ended on a bad note. And I think meaning that I felt like I ended it, as a lot of athletes I imagine do, as a with the feeling of, wow, it's over.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not accomplish what I was capable of accomplishing.
Yeah.
And it really, really hurt. So I hit that moment where you're like, wow, I'm not going to make the Olympic trials. And this is it. I mean, this is it. I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
And so what it, I think what it did for me was, I was very aware that I did not want to feel this type of pain again. So whatever I remember feeling like I was, you know, it sounds like a bad 80s sports movie, but I was like, I'm never going to feel this ever again. You know what I mean?
Well, I felt the same way, so it's okay. Yeah, maybe it is a bad 80s.
I really did think, you know, whatever I do decide to do, I'm all in. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have this again. I don't want to have feeling like, wow, this is it, and I never got to really. So that's how it handed off.
Right, right. So you had all of this aspiration built up inside you and competitive, fiercely competitive, all that thing. So that's what you did. You focused that on becoming an actor.
Yeah, we loaded up a Ryder truck and drove across the country to New York. Mm-hmm. And I began that journey of taking acting classes. And it was all with, okay, very much the same mentality I had as an athlete. Okay, here's what we're going to do. You know, here's the plan.
Yeah.
Here's the goal. Here's the program.
Right.
This is what I want this year. This is what I want next year. And this is what I want in year three. And this is, you know,
right.
Here are the markers.
Wow.
And here we go.
The methodology that from sports carried over into life, which I think all of us do if we're trying to go at something.
Everyone, because, you know, goes about this a different way. It served me very, very well.
Yeah.
It was extremely helpful. In a program to, I didn't know any other way to do it. I just knew, like, okay, this is how I've done things in the past. Yeah. This is what's led to success and or failure in the past, which is you set goals, you set up a program, you work really hard at it.
Right.
And in theory, it should pay off. but I say that in that my particular journey there as an acting student in New York City, waiting tables and bartending, you would, to me, that seemed logical. I assume that's what everybody's doing. It is not what everybody's doing.
No.
When you hear the stat, and this was quite reassuring for me, when I would hear like, you know, 1 out of every 1,000, whatever those stats are, those absurd numbers, is going to make it. Mm. I thought, well, that's not good, you know. But then every person I bartended with or waited tables, if I asked them what they were doing to achieve this dream of being in show business, if they were athletes, they essentially were saying to me, I want to be in the NBA. And I would say, great, what are you doing? And they're like, well, I got an uncle who knows a guy who's a trainer on the Knicks. And I'm hoping he might, you know, give me a shot. That's essentially what most of the people are saying.
So you're saying that they basically were bypassing that brutal hard work and facing disappointment and failure head on and figuring out how to push through it? Is that how?
I think that there is a narrative that is perpetuated that people want to believe in, is that you're going to be discovered, that you're going to, it's just going to be this thing where someone's going to see you and say, I see it. Nobody else sees it, but I see it. Yeah. I think they think it's going to be like modeling. Like, yo, look at this girl who's 5'10 with these crazy cheekbones. She's a model. Well, yeah, that works. But in acting, that's not how it works.
Right.
But it is how the story is often told, or at least it used to be, which is nobody wants to hear an actor talk how hard they worked to, and very few. It's more about look how easy you make it, and look how it just happened.
But that's where the magic is.
Well, of course. So my point being is that, you know, that I think I was really lucky that I had this mentality. Well, that I remember leaving going, well, you know, here's a 50 people I've met who there's no way it's going to work for them. So that just makes my numbers better. Because they're talking crazy talk. That's just not how life works.
Right.
That is just not, you know, you got to go and put in your 10,000 hours and you got to practice.
Which is, yes, exactly. Well, let me tell you the time that I discovered that you were an actor, because needless to say, after swimming, we didn't keep in touch. But
no.
But I too pursued in the entertainment business more of a producer level. So I understand, like, people like You got to work hard.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was toiling in the entertainment business. And then I believe it was like 1999 or something like that. I watched this movie that was getting great reviews and sounded really interesting. Go. And I had no idea you were in that. And I'm like, wait a second. Tim? I'm telling you.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. No, I can imagine.
Is that kind of like what sort of really sort of like gave you some traction?
When it premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, 1999, we thought we were going to be rock stars. I mean, we were the cast. It was a packed theater. It was a standing ovation. It was, there was press. We were in Rolling Stone. We were like, oh, we're the new Brat Pack. I mean, it was a lot of press. And then the movie came out months later and it really didn't
really
make much of a,
don't remember that part.
Make much of a dent. But it like those movies, it hung around.
Yeah.
I mean, not that I expect you to remember, but did you see it in the theater when it first came out? Or did you eventually just kind of see it somewhere, rented it?
I honestly don't remember.
Because most people,
I just remember
it wasn't
discovering
huge,
you.
It was not a huge, I got a lot out of it. And then, of course, I kind of squandered it, I imagine, to some degree. But like I said, it kept giving and it got me another, it led to a part in one of the Scream movies, the second mm-hmm. Scream movie, mm-hmm. which was a tremendous opportunity and break for me. But my career has been pretty sort of, it was sort of a slow build. Well, I mean, to me, it was always a little bit, every big break was overwhelming, but my career was never like, oh my God, you know, just, it was always a big step forward, two steps back.
Right. Nobody sees that stuff. Nobody
slow,
sees,
nobody slow sees, build, dude.
Nobody memorializes all that hard work. And it's, so let's face it, self-doubt and.
I think I was lucky. I think I was terrified of, you know, a huge amount of success. So it was, I think I got lucky. I think I got what I could handle.
Mm.
I don't think I would have been able to handle, you know, now the success that I have now, I can't imagine being able to deal with it then.
Well,
so I'm very lucky.
Well, I don't know in the trajectory of your career, but I certainly next remember Deadwood.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, that was, and that was HBO. That was super high profile and well received. And you really started carving out who you are.
Yeah. I mean, it was just a tremendous opportunity. Now I'm lucky to be able to say I've had more than a handful of these experiences.
Yeah.
At the time, it was one of the very first experiences where I was around true genius,
mm-hmm.
where I was around just a ridiculous amount of talent surrounded by incredible actors on all sides. I just learned a tremendous amount from all of those people.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
Yeah. I can only imagine, like, looking back upon, I revisited, you know, the cast. It's like every single one of those characters and every single one of those actors. Like, they just carved out their role so clearly. It was,
you know, we just did the Deadwood movie.
Yeah.
And whatever it was, a year or so ago.
Last year, right?
Yeah. And it occurred to me that all of those, most of the men that I was surrounded by on that show, the cast,
mm-hmm.
were my age when we were doing the show.
Oh.
We were at the point I'm at right now, probably in their 50s, maybe a little older, but a lot of them, Bill McShane, Sanderson, mm-hmm. Powers Booth, God rest his soul, Brad Dourif, they had already had these incredible careers.
Right.
Where you could say, that's Brad Dourif. You know, he was, you know, that's Billy in you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Or, you know, you'd say.
That's right.
That's, I mean, they all, McShane had this incredible long career, incredible stories. And so Powers, all of them had 20 some odd years of experience, and most, if not all of them, had huge roles, if not multiple big roles in their careers. So to be on a set with all of those mm-hmm. guys was incredible. Watching how they worked, how easy they made it seem, how simple it was. I was, you know, I felt like I was, even at that point, even though I'd been doing it for a while, I'm like, I'm trying way too hard. You know, these guys, just look at them. I learned a very valuable lesson. At the Deadwood party, when they showed the outtakes, I saw all these actors that were in really intense roles, no more or less intense than the role I was in. They were filling up the outtakes, laughing, joking, fucking with each other, purposely joking in between takes, during the take. And I thought to myself, it was one of those moments. I remember being at the party thinking, I got to get into outtakes more. I really do think this is a big deal and a big moment in my learning.
Okay.
Which is, as an actor, I was not having enough fun on the set with my job. As an athlete, it was a game. I mean, I loved training. I loved practicing. I loved goofing around while doing it.
You were always... My recollection of you is that you were always kind of light and having fun, and it was hard.
Exactly.
But that's like also the key to not completely like burning out.
Yes. So if I'm playing a sport, if we're playing basketball, if I'm not in that place where I feel that sense of play, it's usually not a good place for me to excel. Like I realize my game is off. If that's going on, I like to play. I like to work really hard and have a great time doing it.
Do you think that sports prepared you for that realization that you needed to just kind of lighten up and play a little bit more, even through your course of the amazing work you were doing on a series like Deadwood?
I think that I had to relearn that a little bit. I think certain, acting is a little bit different. Well, no, it's similar sports analogy in that it's like basically saying you're constantly moving from, it's a team deal, but you're in different teams. There's different vibes on every set, just like there's a different, right? And there are people that really tend to dictate that mood on that set. So it does feel like a team atmosphere where the coach and the leaders of the team really, you know, it trickles down.
Yeah.
So like college sports, the team captain is a big deal. In college sports,
right.
Those seniors are a big deal. They really create a mood for the athletes that are not the top elite. So if you're a team player, let's say you're not the John Moffitt of the team, you have to find your role in that team, right?
Yeah,
so that you can excel, even though that's a tricky thing to do. I guess the equivalent on a TV show is if you're not the lead of the show, but you're coming in to do a guest star role or you're training, you have to find a way to, because it's not your set, right? Let's say I'm going on, the last job where I had this type of role, I did Fargo, right?
That's out right now.
That's not my set, right? That's the Noah Hawley set.
Yeah.
And Chris Rock is a huge star.
Right.
And he is the big, it's his thing. It's on his shoulders. I come in, I'm doing my part. It's not on my shoulders. There's two things that immediately happen. One, I don't feel the pressure that I bet he feels, because I don't have to carry it. But my job is also to be like, when I come on there, I've been doing this long enough to know I need to make this as much my place for me to do my job. And the way I do like to do my job is I like to play.
Yeah.
So I have to be both respectful of them and their set. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I have to say, but you want me to do my thing. So you're going to need to give me some room to do my thing.
Yeah.
And that's how we're all going to work, right?
Right.
If it's justified, that's my set. So I create the mood for everybody.
Yeah.
And then someone else, all these other character actors have to come in and say, okay, this is the set he's created. And then I have to give them room to do what they want to do.
Well, you're talking about team, basically.
It's exactly what it is. And it's a very curious thing. Like on Deadwood, I think the biggest challenge when I was around David Milch, when I was around Ian McShane, when I was around these guys that are such big personalities, that are such geniuses, the risk is that because they're so good and because they have the answers, is just to show up and kind of feel like, well, they'll tell me what they need. And or you start to shut down because you're over your, you have to kind of still come in and do the work, bring your best self so that you can thrive within mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. Be willing to disagree and yet not have a problem. You know, mm-hmm. all those things are.
Well, chemistry is a tricky thing. I mean, I don't know on a set as much. I mean, I do because but I do know from the team that chemistry is such an enormous factor in the ultimate success.
It really, right? And there's certain athletes that are just going to train differently. They're going to behave differently. This is not what makes them tick.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tricky thing, I imagine, for a coach, for a captain, and then for them themselves to say, how do we all stay together as a team, but how do we give this guy some flexibility to know that this is what he needs, right? He needs that, you know, why isn't so-and-so at practice, right? Because he needs a day off. And you're like, well, does that help or break down? Or when, at what point, who, where do we give, you know?
Right, right, and the trust. Well,
yeah, I think it's a same games being played, yeah.
Just a testament to your willingness to have fun and play is I remember, and I, this was hilarious and I loved it. Indy 103, which is a, okay, come on.
Indy 103, the sports report?
Yes. The sports report with the morning show with Joe Escalante.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the first time that I realized that you're a sports nut too. But on the other hand, you tell me about it.
Well, I don't know. It was somewhere between a sports report and some sort of comedy act. I don't know what it was, but I enjoyed it a great deal. Well,
so did I listening to it.
Yeah, thanks. It was a, I don't know if, you know, Joe, who I just talked to the other day, actually, a great friend. So I was a fan of his show. I was a fan of the Vandals and punk rock and, I just liked a lot about what he did. He and I met. I went in and interviewed, did a thing on the show, and you know, I tend to be like this anyway. I'm like, I love this whole thing that's happening here. I was like, I want to do something on the show, and he's like, what would you do? And I was like, they didn't have a sports reporter on the show, and I said, you know, I could do sports, and I told him to. He's like, I said, call me tomorrow. Call me at the house and I'll do the sports tomorrow and then we'll just see how it goes. So he called me then, you know, did an interview on a Tuesday or something. And on Wednesday, he called me at the house and we went on the air and he said, Tim's here and he's got the sports. And I think the first day I just said, it was just a spontaneous idea. We chatted for a second and then I was like, you know, I went into this sports reporter voice where I was like, let's talk sports. and then I said, you know, Lakers win. You know, I was just doing it off what I remembered from the, you know, last night the Lakers won and the Clippers won. Dodgers lost, you know, bad game, whatever. And then he asked me about the Angels and I said, I don't live in fucking Anaheim. And then he goes, and then I said, and that is sports. And I got on the phone. He texts me and said, you know, that was great.
Yeah.
You want to do it again tomorrow? And I said, sure, call me tomorrow. And we did it for like 2-3 years.
You did it forever. I remember I would, it's like, oh, thank God I get to listen to this. I mean, it was awesome. And it was certainly, I mean, look, it's you.
I had a great time. It was, you know, I really appreciate hearing that. I remember the day someone was delivering something to my house and they said, is it really you? And I said, well, who do you think I am? He goes, you're the guy that does the sports. And I was like,
I love it.
I practically hugged the mailman.
I love it.
Whatever he was. You know, it was an outlet. I love routine. It was fun. It was a, it's the perfect form for me of trying to do some sort of entertainment, which is the upside to that 5 minutes or 3 minutes or whatever it was when in doubt, you could just give the sports information.
Yeah.
You could actually just say, it didn't have to be anything other than, you know, Dodgers won 10-8, you know, mm-hmm. Kershaw pitching or whatever. You could just give information and be useful. And then if it was funny or there was an opportunity for a joke or there was an opportunity to, you know, that was fun too. And because it was so random, because it was a punk rock radio station, it also, as we went along, and I mean this over like over a year, we kept discovering almost anything was somewhat entertaining, meaning mm-hmm. anything, meaning if I got on there and just was like barely asleep and said, you know, hey, Joe, and he's like, you know, let's talk sports. Honestly, I didn't see anything yesterday and I'm exhausted. Can I call you later? And he's like, sure. And I go, that, my friend, is sports, and hang up. That worked. That worked. If I was on set, I could just call and be like, Joe, I'm on the set. I got to go. You know,
that's so awesome.
It somehow, it didn't matter. And then if, you know, you gave a lot of information, that worked too. So it didn't, it was just this fun daily phone call with Joe that I adored him. And it was a way to start your day. I really did love it. I miss it. It's a perfect job.
I remember as a listener, what it served for me is, you know, we're used to seeing you, the polished actor and yeah. everything with music and
yeah.
you know, everything. But this was you were sharing a little piece of you and your personality yeah. and your loves. And you're like, listen, I'm yeah. in the middle of something right now. I can't talk. You
yeah.
know? And that to me,
it's amazing how I tell my kids that, how infectious. I appreciate hearing that. Forgive me, you realize when people, I don't know if I, yeah, it's one of those things where it's really more intimate than you realize, isn't it? You're really letting people in,
which is not common.
Oh, and I think I tell my kids this, who, you know, they're pursuing art or singing and songwriting, that the power of opening yourself up. There's a Bob Dylan line in the new Bob Dylan album where he says, I know how it started. I saw it begin. I opened my soul to the world and the world came in.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Say soul, as you say heart. I opened my heart. I opened my soul to the world. Something like, they opened something to the world and the world came in. I'm like, there it is right there. I guess that's the job, isn't it?
One of the things, we were talking about our daughters, and both of them have gone on to Division I sports careers
yeah.
in college.
Yeah.
It's kind of strange, like kind of following in our footsteps in a way, but yet we understand what they're going through, but yet it's totally different.
It's yeah. You know, but it was so, you know, it's just been a wonderful experience. From my oldest, really got into to tennis. That was her sport. I think it's given her just, it's been fun. It's been great for her. It's been great for us.
Yeah.
My brother was a tennis player at SC when I swam. So it also included, my brother in the,
yeah.
you know, and the three of us now.
Well, you're quite the tennis player.
So and through her, I became more of a tennis player because I was like the go-to, you know, and I loved it. But I was like the go-to hitting partner as when she would be warming up for a tournament yeah. and stuff like that. And as she got really good, in order to stay her hitting partner,
you had to up your game.
I was like, wow, I gotta. And then just competitive nature. But now the three of us play together, and that is really quite special.
That is awesome. Isn't it great, like watching your children discover the things that you were discovered from sports, you know, which is focus,
yeah.
Dealing with failure.
Yeah.
It all starts with hard work. All of those things that I hold near and dear, which I believe you were basically saying you as well.
Yeah. I think those things, I'm a big fan of, you know, the it's funny. It doesn't matter. It's sports, but I bought this tile that was from at the Museum of LACMA here in LA. We have that tile sitting in the front entrance of our house, but one of the rules of the art school is do the work. And people who do the work tend to figure things out, you know.
Wow, yeah.
Sports, there's no escaping it. other professions, it's easier to try to get around it.
You think so? Do you think truly excelling in anything, you have, don't you have to work hard to truly excel in most everything?
I do. What I'm saying is that there is, I think there are other professions where my profession, for example, you don't have to be very good at what you do to be very successful. Now, long term, you know, those things don't tend to hang around, but everybody knows they can go and see a, anyone listening knows you can go see a really bad movie that's a huge success.
Yeah.
Right. So that's my point. You can also, everyone also knows big stars who are widely considered to not be very good at what they do. Right. That doesn't happen in sports. There's no one who's like, you know what's crazy? He's not that good a tennis player. Top 10 in the world.
Yeah.
there's no version of that.
That is something we learned the hard way, hard way trying
to compete. One of the things you learn in my work is that you won't necessarily, the best person won't necessarily get the job. That's one thing you have to kind of, that wouldn't happen in swimming. If you won, you won. If your time is this time, that's it. There's no, in my profession, you can be like, well, here's the good news. You were the fastest.
Yeah.
The bad news is you're fifth. Yeah, you got fifth place. You're like, wow, I don't understand. That's a head scratcher. So look, there's a lot of things, you know, it's all about the hair. But my daughter, I think,
or lack. Sorry, I have to make a self-deprecating joke.
Listen, that gets you a job. So, you know, anyway, it's been wonderful for her, I assume. And it's been fun. It's been a lot of fun to watch. It was a lot of fun. Boy, it brought up so many memories along the way. Yeah. Boy, so many memories.
I'm just thankful that they've been blessed with being able to experience college in this way. Because you and I were blessed with that as well.
Oh, I think being part of a team, showing up, you know, if nothing else, it just gives you an identity. Yeah. To then work from, you know, someone once told me, if you want to know what your kids are like, just look at their friends. I've been, you know, for her and with all my kids, you know, she's surrounded by some really great people.
Yeah.
And that tends to happen in athletics.
I agree.
It tends, especially as you go along, I mean, there's exceptions to that rule, but if nothing else, you know what, she's healthy.
Yeah.
You know, she's
thriving.
Oh, it's going to serve for the rest of her life. Yeah.
So you mentioned a little bit earlier that longevity is something like talent. It takes talent to have longevity in a career. And your career has been long, quite a long career. And it's been a blast following it for me. Right now you have Fargo, but just last week,
oh yeah,
I mean, come on, Mandalorian.
You know what? I can tell you this. A lot of people watch that show.
Yeah, yeah.
What fun!
You got to share. Oh, okay. If I knew back then that the guy in the next lane over there is going to be in Star Wars sharing a scene with Yoda, okay, it's Baby Yoda. But
now, can I tell you the most exciting was the Jawas? I got to do a scene with the Jawas.
Oh yeah,
that was like, I really enjoyed the job. That whole experience, like Kid in a Candy Store, the way they make that show alone. I met John. We worked on the script for a while, and we had this nice meeting, went over it all, and he's really a very collaborative in that process, and we really tweaked all the dialogues and just had a blast. And then he's like, hey, I want to show you the set. And we proceeded to go into a room, just this black box of a room. Like a small gymnasium size room. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And as we entered, he said, yeah, this is where we shot Lion King. And I was like, what are you talking about? And the whole thing was shot in this black box with all these, you know, digital. I mean, that blew me away. Then he's like, I was like, so where's the set? And he handed me a virtual reality mask. And John, Pedro, the DP, myself, we all, each of us put on a virtual reality headset. And we went to the set. And we went and visited Mospelga, forgive me, but I don't remember the name of the planet.
Yeah.
And we went to the town of Mospelga, I guess, on Tatooine.
Tatooine.
Which we shot in Marina Del Rey.
That is awesome.
Now, when they shot Luke Skywalker on Tatooine in the 70s when we were growing up.
Where was
Morocco.
It? Morocco, there you go.
I just went about 20 miles south down to Marina Del Rey.
Crazy.
To the same planet. And so we went into virtual reality and we walked around, we saw the set, we moved all, you can move all through it and he can show me like, here's the door. And at first I was like, wait, are we shooting this in virtual, in this black box? He goes, no, this is the digital 3D, you know, version of this, of the set, of the town. We will now build a lot of this, but we build it first in virtual reality.
Uh-huh.
And he can set up all the shots. We can rehearse the scene.
Crazy.
We did a walk and talk up and down the boardwalk, and he realized he needed about 20 more yards of boardwalk, and it just digitally appeared.
Wow.
And then he realized that when the dragon came around, he didn't like where one of the buildings was. He brought the dragon in. There's a giant dragon in
front.
No way. And then one of the buildings, but they can just pick it up with their little laser thing, whatever, they have pointer, and pick it up and move the building. And say, yeah, I'd like it a little bit more there. So when we get to the set, it's all been done. It's all been built specifically to this. It was incredible. Anyway, I had a blast doing it. But the day and the whole, so my point is the whole thing was fun. All the blue screen, the digital screen that moves. It's like a ride at Star Wars. I've stood in line for over an hour. And then I was there every day, no line. Take after take was like, doing the ride again. It was like just cutting in line.
That's
crazy. I was riding these speeders through a canyon and I was like, this is a ride at Disneyland. It's on hydraulics. It's incredible. But as fun as all that was, the day I was there and I was in this scene with the Jawas, I was like, wow, my whole childhood is just
right.
Just all of a sudden.
I mean, come on.
As much as I knew I was in a Star Wars thing, that day, that moment, I was like, wow, I'm in fucking Star Wars. I was like, this is, it's like Han Solo and Mark Hamill and me. We're like the only people that have worked with these people. I just remember being like, this is, here I am. The sand people, yeah, but the Jawas, for some reason, boy, that just brought me right back to like being a kid in Modesto.
Here you are.
It was bizarre. Talk about a moment.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. Well, thank you for sharing.
It was fun.
That moment and others with me. My gosh, what a rich life that you have led.
Well,
and
both of us, my friend, we've both been very, very lucky. We've been very, very lucky.
Absolutely, very lucky, very blessed, and willing to work hard and take risks.
Sonia, they say chlorine's bad for you, but I think I think we're living proof that there must be some upside to it.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for spending so much time, chlorine or not. We will maybe go swimming together one of these days.
Can't wait for that pool to open up again, dude. Can't wait for that pool to open back up.
And I certainly look forward to also hearing about some of your next adventures.
Yeah, well, likewise. I mean, this has been really great seeing you again. And I look forward to some more excuses to hang out.
Indeed, me too. Yeah. Thanks.
All right, man. Pleasure.
We're all trying to find that elusive happy place in our work, call it balance or whatever you like. Timothy found it while working on the set of Deadwood when he realized he simply wasn't having enough fun. So I'll sign out today with a few different quotes all about finding that sense of play while you work. First, a proverb from the 17th century. All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. This one, for most of us, is a well-worn idiom. But for me, it was made famous by Jack Nicholson in The Shining. And here's a simple gem from Leo Tolstoy. If you want to be happy, be. And a final quote. You've achieved success in your field when you don't know whether what you're doing is work or play. This one from Academy Award-winning director and actor Warren Beatty. This week, I encourage you to find or maybe even rediscover your sense of play. Exactly the way Timothy did, first as an athlete and then an actor. I hope you enjoyed hearing from Timothy Oliphant this week, and thanks for tuning in to the premiere episode of Sports Life Balance. If you like the show, share it with a friend, and please leave a 5-star review on iTunes.
It really helps. I'm John Moffett, and until next week, be well, everyone.